I appreciate this more than you will know in this lifetime. I love this school. I'm deeply grateful for the opportunity to be a physician. Many of us that were in those early classes came into medicine from other careers. I was an educator and historian, a philosopher with advanced degrees in both, and when I started medical school. I fell in love with medicine under the tutelage of Dr. Forlan, Dr. Pestana, and dozens of other men and women of great significance. 48 years ago, on December 7th, I had my first date with a young lady. She was beautiful and bright and popular, and I was kind of a curmudgeon. She had asked me to marry her 15 times, and I turned her down. But on February 7th, I yielded and asked her to marry me. On August the 7th of 1965, at the same time that Medicare became the law of the land, she said, "I do." There have been times when she might have responded, "I shouldn't," but for 47 years plus several months, Carolyn Ballou Holly has been at my side all through medical school and all through my professional career. And I can truthfully say that as the laziest person that I've ever met in my life, me, and the most misdirected, without her, I truly, genuinely, and sincerely tell you, I would not have been who I am today. And I thank her, and God bless you. My children, half of them are not here, and half of them are. And they're the joy and the light of my life, and I'm so grateful for them. 43 years ago, I received a letter. My wife framed it for me, so I have it. November 22nd, 1968, signed by Dr. Carter Pannell, who is one of my heroes. He was the dean of the School of Medicine when I was accepted. And September of 1969, I became a freshman here. That started a journey that has been the most exciting thing in my life professionally. And I remember each day of it. I have clear memories of so many things, lectures and experiences. On Wednesday, I wrote Dr. William Hendrich, who is the presently on leave due to illness as president of the Health Science Center. And I said this: "As Carol and I prepare to go to San Antonio this weekend to receive the honor which I most desired in this life, to be a distinguished alumnus of my beloved School of Medicine, I wish to tell you and Mary," Dr. Hendrich's wife, "that if I had a choice of knowing you and being your friend or receiving this award, I would choose to be your friend. You have afforded me opportunities which I never imagined would be possible, and I'm grateful. You have extended your warm embrace to me and my family beyond anything I could have imagined, and I am grateful. As Carol and I continue to hope and to believe for your full and complete recovery, we want you to know the esteem in which we hold you and the love which we have for both of you." Bill Hendrich is the second bookend of my professional career. Dr. Carter Pannell was the first. I wrote his family. He passed away this last summer. I attended his memorial service in Seguin in August. And I told his family, "I shall carry with me to the event, to this event, the framed copy of my letter of acceptance in the to the 1960 entering class, signed by my dean, Carter Pannell. My greatest regret is that your father and grandfather will not be there. In my professional career, no person has influenced me more than Dr. Pannell. I could no more call him Carter than I could stop breathing. He shall always be the epitome of professionalism, leadership, scholarship, and the kind of physician I have always wanted to be. You know these things, but as I stand before the convocation on Saturday morning evening, I want to know that I have laid this honor at his feet and express my gratitude that I knew him and loved him and that he respected me. No honor could be more valued by me. I'm pleased for you to know that in my judgment, Dr. Hendrich and your father are men of the same caliber and cut from the same cloth. I think your father would like that. These events, my marriage, my matriculation in the medical school, my knowing of these two men, have been those bookends. I've always been proud of my school of medicine. I often wondered if my school of medicine could and would be proud of me. And that has been somewhat of a motivating factor in my life, to live a life that would be worthy of the honor of my class, and my school. I've always admired the basic science education that we received. I've admired the research and faculty, staff, and appointments that take place here. I have based my practice on evidence-based medicine, created through basic science and clinical science. I admire and respect those who go into the laboratory every day and do arcane experiments that suddenly burst upon the scene and become the stuff of clinical medicine. I have lived the proposition with my patients that if you make a change, it will make a difference in your life. And I can only do that because of the evidence-based medicine that we're able to practice. It is because of that basic science, the Krebs cycle, the adenosine triphosphate, ATP, energy metabolism, exercise physiology, pulmonary physiology, that we're able in clinical practice now to confront all of our patients with weight management assessments, with exercise prescriptions that are uniquely prepared for them individually, and with the motivation to stop smoking and stop destroying their lungs. We call it the LESS initiative, L for lose weight, E for exercise, and SS for stop smoking. AHRQ, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality in Washington, an agency of HHS, has published our LESS initiative on their innovation exchange and recommended it to practices across America. I'm also proud of the clinical science at our school, and now that department of the Clinical Skills Center that scared me to death, and I'm so grateful it didn't exist when I was here. It's so intimidating, but it's obvious that it's working remarkably well. I am so grateful that we can do population management now because of the informatics and the analytics that we're able to do. We do statistical analysis on our patients, and we know for the last 14 years what our standard deviations have been for hemoglobin A1Cs. We not only improve our mean, median, and mode, but we also work on improving our standard deviation to make sure that we're giving everyone the quality of care that they require. We personally and publicly report by provider name on over 300 quality metrics. All of this I learned here. Everything I do every day is motivated by the standards I saw, the examples I've watched, and the people that I want to emulate in my life. We've been able to eliminate ethnic disparities in diabetes and hypertension care. We have not yet achieved that in dyslipidemia, but we're working on it. And as I'm proud of the basic sciences and as I'm proud of the clinical sciences, I am also proud of the human sciences that are exemplified at our school. 2.5 years ago, I wrote the following. As we move deep into the 21st century, we do so knowing that the technological advances we face are astonishing. Our grandchildren's generation will experience methods and possibilities which seem like science fiction to us today. Yet, that technology risks decreasing the value of our lives if we do not, in the midst of technology, retain our humanity. As we celebrate science, we must not forget to embrace the minister, the ethicist, the humanist, the theologian, indeed those who remind us that being the bionic man and woman will not make us more human, but it seriously risks causing us to be dehumanized. And in doing so, we may restore the balance between technology and trust and hope, which will make us find solutions for healthcare's problems as we go forward. Technology can contribute to the solving of most of the disease processes that we have, but ultimately cannot solve the health problems that we have. Winston Churchill is my secular hero. In 1912, when the Titanic sunk, Winston did as he often did every day of his life, even as Prime Minister. He wrote his wife. They were apart again. And he said, the attention is all on this sinking of the Titanic. And he said, the news is good. The great traditions of the sea, women and children first, have been maintained. He said, I'm proud of our race. And he said, and of the traditions, he said, first, the women and children being tossed about on the sea, and the rest, silence. Honor be to their memory. 48 hours later, he wrote another note to his wife, and he said, I continue to be preoccupied with this, with the Titanic. He said, if this had been Imperial Rome or ancient Greece, the potentates, the swells, those who were rich and powerful would have gone first. Then the sailors and the captain being in the lead of that. And then those who could bribe the way. And to hell with the rest. And he said something that's instructive for us. But he said, such ethics can neither build the Titanic with technology nor lose it with honor. I believe what we want to do as we pursue solutions to healthcare complex problems today is not only do we want to win with technology, but we also want to do it with honor and with hope and with trust. Not only am I proud of the basic science and proud of the clinical sciences, but I'm proud of the human sciences. I'm proud of the Medical Humanities and Ethics Center here. And for the last several days, I've had the pleasure of participating in three lectures. The first was about global health. I can't do anything about global health individually. But I can lead my practice to do a survey and test every patient we see from age 13 to 64 for HIV/AIDS, whether they're positive or negative, whether they have high-risk behaviors or not. And we have done that now for the last 2 years, finding several people who are positive. And HIV/AIDS is something you can live successfully and healthily with if you know you have it, but it will kill you if you don't. I can treat people with dignity and respect. A physician in our community was indicted and ultimately convicted of being a molester of a minor. He was my colleague and my friend, and I called him the day that his indictment became public knowledge. And I said, you're my friend, and I obviously object to what you've done, but I want to help if I can. Over the next 9 months, my wife and I befriended him, loved him, and cared for him. He found he was HIV positive. He developed HIV infection. And in December of that same year, my wife held his left hand, and I held his right as he died. He didn't have to be alone. As he breathed his last breath, I looked down at my hand, which was holding his hand, and his thumb nail was bleeding, and the blood was dropping on my hand. I felt no panic or no anxiety. I simply went and scrubbed it carefully, not foolishly ignoring it, but being thankful that regardless of the circumstances of life, the humanity, the ethics, that we can love and care for people. I want to be an excellent scientist as a physician, practicing basic science in clinical science settings, but also to do it with humanity and with compassion and love and care. I heard a second lecture about literature and medicine, and I was reminded that everyone has a story. Have you ever listened to people's conversations? I get my hair cut with a lot of women around. I'm telling you, it is startling to hear the conversations. And I stay silent for fear of being mobbed if I should open my mouth. But wherever people are, they're on buses and public conveyances, they're in stores and walking about, and they're talking because they have a story that defines who they are. And literature and medicine, we think in terms of great writers and published manuscripts. But most people's literature is oral history. And much of their literary knowledge is movies. But everybody has a story. And as I am a scientist and know the Krebs cycle and delight in the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation and love biochemistry to this day and love physiology and the concept of physiology, I never want to lose sight of the fact that nobody is a diabetic, nobody is an appendix, nobody is a cancer of the colon. They are human beings with hopes, ambitions, expectations, desires, and I want to love them and care for them as individuals. 3.5 years ago, I made rounds one morning, and I'm there quite early, and the nurses said, "You don't want to go into this room." I said, "Why?" She said, "The man said he's going to kill the next doctor that walks in the room." Well, that got my attention. And I said, "Does he have a gun?" And they said, "We don't think he does." I said, "Fine, let's go see him." They found two burly guys by the time I got to the room. They had run down the hall and were walking in with me. And I walked in. I stood at the end of his bed. I didn't know him. And I said, "May I listen to your lungs?" And he was taken aback. And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah." You know what had never happened? This man had nothing. He had no money, he didn't have a job, he had no position, he had no power, he had no fame, he had no person. He had always been treated as an object. No one had ever asked him for permission to enter his personal space. I examined him and then I listened to him for 30 minutes telling me his story. It was a heart-wrenching story. And I realized my job was not to treat his physical illness, which was significant. But my job was to treat his soul and to give him a sense of worth and value. And I thought about a way to do that, and so I gave him my cell phone number. And I said, "You've had trouble working through the healthcare system. You now have access to it through me. Call me anytime, day or night." 3.5 years later, this man who threatened to kill the next doctor who walked in the room is my dear friend. He is still without a job, he still has no money, he still has no power, but he has a friend, and he now has value. He was indicted for a crime he didn't commit. He was convicted because he had a second-rate lawyer who neglected him, whom I assaulted, not physically, but. And our foundation is now paying his parole cost for his parole officer, because if we didn't, he would be sent to jail. Now, who would ever think that a physician's practice would be responsible for paying somebody's parole fees? Most people say, "Well, it's your fault, you've done this." Well, it wasn't his fault. He's caught up in this maelstrom of negativity. He called me 5 months ago. He said, "Well, it's time again." I said, "Well, tell me how much it is." And we paid the next 6 or 12 months, and he'll get off parole soon. But you know, it's my wife knows who this man is. And he called me while I was here. He needed to see me before he sees his parole officer the next time, and so I made a special appointment to see him on Monday. I want to tell you something. I've never had a more pleasant experience of practicing medicine than with this man. I've seen a man's life transformed because he has hope, trust, and he has significance. And what a precious gift I can give him to give him that. Medicine and literature is really listening to people's stories. If I told you what patient-centered medical home is, and I've written 65 articles that are on our website if you're interested about patient-centered medical home, I want to tell you it's about knowing that everyone has a story and delighting in that story. Thirdly, last night I didn't attend the barbecue, but I went to the medicine and music. What an absolute delight. Dr. Kogan is a professor of psychiatry and a graduate of Juilliard School of Music. He gave us a lecture intermixed with playing Beethoven sonatas and concerti, and it was thrilling and wonderful. I wish I were trained in music, but I'm not, but I adore music. You know why I learned to love music? In cartoons. I grew up in a home where there were no books, and we only had country western music. But I'd go to the movie on Saturday afternoon with my friends, and I would listen to the cartoons. I loved the hijinks. I was a kid. But the music was enthralling. It was classical music. And I fell in love with the music, and I've loved it all of my life. As I listened to him in this issue of medicine and music, I realized that they are a metaphor for each other, if you will. The physics of harmonics and the science of equilibrium and balance are not dissimilar. It is, in fact, the harmonics. It is the melody. It is the construction and the mathematical construction of music that has dissonance and has cacophony. It has a conflict and then a resolution and a beautiful melody that comes forth out of the conflict. Isn't that what medicine really is? We have patients in the throes of illnesses that are wrecking and devastating their lives. They're out of equilibrium, either because of sociological issues or socioeconomic issues or because of health issues. Dr. Hendrich, who had a stem cell transplant, is doing very well, I'm delighted to say. He had to go through a crisis, a cacophony of noise to have his bone marrow wiped out with the potential in the first 2 weeks of that he could die. But now the melody is coming forward and the harmony is returning. The equilibrium is returning to his body. And there's an enormous probability of his being cured. It is like that with medicine and like that with music. You know, there are two Greek words that have been transliterated into English. One of them is the word exekeo, and you hear the word echo in there. It has been translated in one source as the sounding board because it means the sounding forth. And are we not each a sounding board for the melody of our school of medicine? Do we not daily exhibit and demonstrate to others the joy we have of being physicians and the delight we have in being entrusted with the care of people that need our care and that we partner with to help them restore their health or maintain their health? It is that exekeo, it is that echo as we become that sounding board. If you listen to a piano, you know, most of Beethoven's music was written for the harpsichord early on. He received his first pianoforte, the expansion of the harpsichord keyboard, two octaves, one on each end, and he received his first pianoforte from the John Broadwood Company in England. And he began to prepare music for the piano soft forte, hard, the pianoforte. And as he prepared that music, it's the same way we do medicine and the same thing that we do. There's another word that has to do with the sounding together. It has to do with harmonics. If you take 1,000 tuning forks of different frequencies and put them in this room and you thump one of them, every tuning fork in this room that is that same frequency or multiple of that frequency will begin to sound. All others will remain silent. We learned our frequency of vibration here at this school as we were trained and taught and as we breathe deeply into enculturating ourselves in the passion of healthcare. We became a tuning fork, and now we sound together. The word that's translated from the Greek is symphonia. We get our word symphony from the same thing. We are indeed the instruments of the symphony of medicine, of health, not of disease. Science can help us deal with disease, but the symphony of our lives, the harmony of our lives, will produce the music. One of my favorite movies, part of my literature, is Mr. Holland's Opus. If you've seen it, you remember it. If you haven't, you must. Whether you like movies or not, you would enjoy this one. At the end, he felt like his life was not a success. He felt like he'd never achieved his goal of writing a great symphony. One of his former students, who was governor of his state, said to him, "We are your symphony. We are the notes and melodies of your opus. We are the music of your life. And so we are the music of the life of Marvin Forlan and Dr. Carlos Pestana and all the other men and women who invested their lives and ours coming to a cow pasture and believing that something would rise up that would be worthy of scientific excellence and basic science, clinical excellence, but also in human excellence. As we continue to live our lives, I know the day will come when my instrument will be silenced. There will be some who will rejoice on that day. I have reasonably certain that in my community I will have the largest funeral that ever has existed. As many will come and say, I just want to make sure that he's dead. We have gathered here today for a very special purpose. And I cannot tell you how much it means to me. In this life, there's no honor that I would like to have had. I've told one person only, my wife, you know, someday I would hope that my life would be worthy of this. I can't tell you that I think it is, but I am so grateful. And I receive this with the humility that will engender what humility always brings in the life of another. And that's diligence and discipline. I can assure you that this will not create arrogance or haughtiness of look and see who I am, but I will return to my office on Monday in my practice, and I will think of ways that I can live my life over the next however many years I have, 20 or 30, in such a way that I can make you proud that you have done this wonderful thing for me. It will motivate and stimulate. It will undergird me. It will give me strength and direction. I cannot be more grateful. I cannot be more grateful for our school, for the Health Science Center, for all the wonderful things that I cannot believe that I've been blessed to be a part of. I am so grateful to you, and I thank you, and God bless you. Thank you.